Welcome to WebAx, practical web accessibility tips.
WebAx.blogspot.com.
WebAx. Website accessibility. Web standards.
Hello and welcome to WebAx, podcast number 74, awards, events, and back to basics. This is Dennis.
And this is Ross.
And we're joining you today for the first time from Santa Cruz, California.
Yes, yes, a very accessible Santa Cruz now, because we're here.
Is this the first time we're doing a podcast together, like physically in the same room?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Which is kind of why we couldn't figure out how we're going to actually record it.
It's like we're not using Skype. How the hell are we going to record the podcast?
So hopefully this works out pretty well. We did some audio tests and it seems to sound pretty good.
Well, we're going to use your Mac, so we should be good.
Right. Everything's better on a Mac.
So you want to mention real fast what you're doing in Santa Cruz or what kind of fun you've had?
Yeah, so I'm in here in Santa Cruz, California.
NorCal, baby.
NorCal, yes. Yeah. It's not too far from where Dennis is.
Just over the hill from Cupertino.
Right. It's like a half-hour drive, right?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, it's not too bad. But I flew in for some small business stuff, but figured, you know, when you're from Michigan, you have a chance to go into to California, you take a couple extra days to do things like trying to surf, which I've now done twice, and deep sea fishing, which is also pretty cool. So I've enjoyed NorCal. I like where you live.
Awesome. I heard you did, well, surfing and you caught three fish too.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yep, I was successful in fishing, and actually the hotel here was pretty nice, and they even cooked it for me in a variety of different ways. So rather than let that fish go to waste, I had some nice fresh fish, compliments of the, what's it called, the Chaminade Resort and Spa.
Yeah, that's an awesome place to stay.
Yep.
Real nice rooms.
Get my approval.
So anyways, yeah, so this is the first time. It's kind of funny. This is our four-year anniversary for WebAx. I guess we've been podcasting. You joined about 3 years ago.
Right.
So, yeah, so this is the first time we're actually doing it, like we said, not remotely. So
right.
It's pretty cool. It's different.
A milestone on many levels.
Yeah. So anyways, yeah, so congrats to WebAx for their 4 years. And, and we're increasing growth steadily in readership and listeners. So thank you out there to everybody listening.
Yeah. We're actually getting close to podcast 100. Although doing it month by month, I suppose that's going to take a little while, another 2 years or so. But
it's been going slowly, but definitely surely.
Right. I have faith we'll hit that 100th episode mark.
Yeah, me too. So on another note, we have a great audience out there and a great niche and potential for advertisers. So if anyone is interested, it's only $150. And we'll put an ad in the podcast for you and a mention on the blog.
Yep. Our listeners are anything from web developers to web professionals and people using the web. So
web standards and, of course, web accessibility advocates and experts.
Yep. So a real opportunity to reach your target market.
Mm-hmm. And assistive technology users.
Yep. And then the next thing, hopefully all of you users listeners have already seen this and voted, but we were nominated in the 2009.net awards in actually two places.
Which is better than last year, because last year was the first year we were nominated for best podcast of the year, as we are this year. So, go and check that out and vote like Ross suggested, if you haven't. And what was the second nomination, Ross?
All right, so they have the what's called the Infamy Award, which is the biggest blunders on the web or something like that.
Yeah, it's like a booby prize.
Right. And luckily it's nothing that we did, but Dennis found, if you look at our CAPTCHA episode, there's an example of a horribly inaccessible, unreadable CAPTCHA. I think it's like, 20 characters long or something like that.
Yeah.
And So basically, the .NET people thought that was pretty good, and that was also nominated. So vote for us in both categories so that we can win both of them.
Yeah. But I don't know. We'll see if BOAG World pulls through again.
Right.
They're probably a favorite, I assume.
Yeah.
They won last year.
Tough competition. Although, yeah. I didn't notice that Paul BOAG of BOAG World is one of the judges. So it kind of
is he really?
Yeah. Yeah. How fair is that?
Well, maybe he's not judging the podcast category.
Well, I'd hope not.
That'd be a conflict of interest.
Right.
Well, I've already won an award for Accessible Twitter.
Yeah.
Yay. So
that just happened recently,
good.
Right?
Yep, this past week. For the Access IT 2009 Awards, there was 4 categories. So Accessible Twitter, my baby this year, has won the first prize for the Web 2.0 category. So that was great. And there was a... like a 2-day, what do you call it? I don't know. If it's a mini conference and award show and stuff in London. And so I contacted my Twitter friend, Mira Tank, and she represented me in Accessible Twitter and gave a presentation at the awards. So thanks, Mira, for doing that. And the presentation is on SlideShare if you want to check that out. And the there's a fully web accessible HTML version, and I'll post the link for that. Well, it's already posted on the blog if you haven't seen it, so check that out.
And your presentation got pretty popular in SlideShare, right?
Yeah. It SlideShare had put it on the featured list on the homepage, the featured presentations and documents list. So it was the first one on there for a while the other day. And so for the first, like, 4 or 5 days now, it has almost 700 views. So check out that presentation. It's pretty good. I'm talking about the shortcomings of web accessibility on Twitter and how AccessibleTwitter.com handles those issues. And that's pretty much it. But it's a good presentation, I think, definitely to check out.
Well, congratulations. Looks like the award that they gave you is pretty cool.
Yeah, Mira has it in London. It's a it's like this nice, heavy, crystal glass lead thing. I don't know. She said she'd take a picture of it and send it to me. So.
Excellent.
Yeah, that was pretty nice. And so
someday, I imagine, you'll actually have it in your hands.
Yeah, hopefully.
Good excuse to go to London, if nothing else.
Yeah. I would love to take a trip out there. WebEx. Any good articles lately, Ross, going around the web?
Yeah, there's a few of them. You know, there's so much kind of going on lately with, you know, different levels of browser support, and CSS3 is getting more popular, and HTML5.
Yeah, there's lots of stuff going around.
Yeah.
Around accessibility and HTML5 is...
What are the implications?
ARIA and everything else.
Right.
There's lots of stuff happening right now. It's
an
exciting time.
So I did come across one article that talks about HTML5 and then the canvas element and how that relates to accessibility. And really, this is a huge kind of potential open hole in accessibility in HTML5 because the canvas element, now you can do so much with it. With that, you'll be able to draw entire interfaces and that sort of thing, through HTML, but there isn't, you know, good ways to designate, what things actually are from accessibility standpoint. So if you drew your menu with the canvas element, you might not be able to identify that as a menu, which if you have a screen reader, of course, what are you going to do? Or if you, have motor disabilities or using an assistive device, what are you going to do?
Yeah. As never too keen on that canvas idea. I'm still not so sure about it. I mean...
Yeah. I mean, it seems like there's a lot of potential there. You know, you can do a lot of cool stuff with it, but they just haven't figured out how to do it in a way that's accessible, and that's a huge
problem.
I mean,
what's the advantage over it, over, like, SVG?
I think it's supposed to be a better SVG. I'm not exactly sure how it's better. But a lot of those like font replacement techniques end up using the canvas element on some level.
Huh. Yeah, well, I guess we'll find out more about it soon. Yeah, I came across an article. It's an interview with Jamie Knight, Autism and Accessible Web Design. And
yeah, I read through this one. I thought it was pretty interesting. It kind of strays from the traditional sort of viewpoint as far as accessibility, screen readers or assistive devices.
Yeah, a lot of people talk about, especially, you know, the visually impaired or,
right.
or you know, are, you know, or being hearing impaired and sometimes, you know, mobility impairments, but hardly ever, you know, talk about the cognitive impairments and things
right.
like that. And it's the least popular and most difficult area
right.
of web accessibility. So this is a nice personal article from someone who has autism and discussing just... And she does web design as well, so she answers questions about, you know, which sites she finds most difficult and just different issues around that.
Yeah, and it's pretty interesting, some of the things that you might not necessarily think about that could be an accessibility problem. She talked about how there's a potential to be overwhelmed if there's a lot going on. So if you've ever kind of dealt with a meeting where people are talking about, well, let's add some motion because it's interesting. You know, it's good to know that that potentially could cause an overwhelming in somebody who has a cognitive disability, and it would make them hard to think about what they should be doing on the page. And of course, there's always kind of like going to an extreme and flashing and seizures and stuff like that. But so yeah, it's a good article.
Yeah. It
really kind of makes you think and, definitely an area of accessibility you shouldn't forget about.
Definitely. Okay, next article. Are PDFs more important than web accessibility? And did you read that whole article?
I didn't
either.
I can't answer it, but it sounds important.
I think one of the arguments was that PDFs are maybe more popular but less accessible than the web, like in general.
That could be.
You know, and that, you know, people aren't paying attention to PDFs nearly as much as they should. You know, like web accessibility is starting to become more popular, and so maybe now PDF accessibility needs more attention.
Yeah, and there's some real kind of side benefits to making your PDFs accessible because it does allow the search engines to actually read through them and, like, figure out what sort of information's there. And I'm noticing more and more that PDFs will actually show up in search results for more kind of specific things.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's good just to make sure that people who download them, you know, can use them. and, but also, yeah, to it can actually get you more traffic and more downloads of those PDFs. And I assume you're putting them online because you actually want people to read them, I'd assume.
Yeah. So. The article starts off saying that... we recently did an audit of a website where probably close to 99% of all the information it contained was in downloadable documents, mostly PDFs. So, I mean, it's a good preface for the article saying that, you know, if you're downloading a lot of information, and a lot of people do this, you know, from the internet, like PDF documents and everything, that obviously the PDFs should be accessible. But at the same time, you know, hardcore critics will tell you, and I kind of agree that, you know, all your information on the web should be in some kind of HTML format, and the PDFs should just be like, you know, like an added bonus for
right.
for more like pretty stuff,
right?
Or more maybe more detailed stuff.
Right. I could see it as like if you have a nice printable version that you want to be, a nice flyer sort of thing, where just a print style sheet maybe wouldn't do the trick. But yeah, I agree. I mean,
if you have charts and all this pretty stuff in your PDF, that's fine. You could probably make that accessible. But, I mean, you could just put a data table on your web page, right? I mean, that's not that difficult.
Or use some graphics, you know, if it's a chart with the right alt text or long description. So there's definitely ways to do it. I mean, I struggle to think of too many examples of a PDF that you couldn't just put into an HTML document.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, I mean, the side benefits, again... that's going to be much more searchable and rank a lot higher and get a lot more traffic.
It's funny how all this stuff comes back to just, we'll talk about this in a little bit, but just the basic things, you know,
right.
And kind of the theme of this podcast is like, where do you start when you make an accessible PDF? Well, you start with the same thing to make an accessible Word file and HTML file, proper headings,
right?
Alternative text for images,
right.
You know, lists for lists and data tables. I mean, and why can't anybody do that?
Right.
Yeah. So anyways, okay. I'll rant about that more in a few minutes. Okay. I wanted to mention one last article. And I haven't read it entirely through this one either, but, it's about, the Pacello, group, has an article out about, Google's, Chrome Frame for IE.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Right.
And they put out an article saying how that, there's like a big accessibility black hole.
Huh.
Did you see that article?
No. I've definitely heard criticism for the, Chrome Frame for IE. So essentially the idea is that, Google released, it's a plugin. And is it JavaScript based or is it something built into the browser?
I'm not sure what it's called.
Yeah.
Technically how it works, but actually at the open web group yesterday, I spoke to a couple times one of the main guys who programmed that thing.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And there was some talk about there was one session about trying to get people to upgrade their browsers and the problems with that. And then this one,
right.
And this particular guy like attended that session and
ooh.
Yeah, a couple people got into it a little bit.
Right.
And like then there was you know, representation from Opera. Then this one guy was saying how all developers use Firefox and yeah, it was getting kind of heated.
Yeah.
And the room was already hot because there was no air conditioning. Anyways,
almost a brawl at the open web camp, huh?
Well, I wouldn't say that, but I get a little steamy. But
right. So the plugin, what it does is it basically makes IE take advantage of a lot of the things that Chrome does. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's basically it uses the Chrome rendering engine basically to like do. Oh, but it's opt in, which is the good part about it.
Right.
There's two opt ins. The first opt in is that the user has to, put it in the browser, install the plugin. But the second opt-in, which is you have to mention, of course, is that the website or web page has to have a certain like meta tag or something.
Oh, okay.
So that so a site, even if you have the plugin and you go to like say CNN.com, if they don't have the meta tag, then it won't use it.
Gotcha.
So if the webmaster decides or developer, you know, puts this meta tag to use Chrome, only then will it use the Chrome frame.
So it has to be very specific.
Yeah, so so the user has to have installed and the developer has to put the tag into the site to use Chrome instead of IE.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, I assume their goal there was to give users who are stuck on IE for some reason, like they're not allowed to install another browser.
Exactly.
A way to have a better rendering engine, I guess.
Yeah. Because some people either just, you know, can't afford, you know, upgrading their Windows system, or they're stuck because they're stuck in some huge company that can't upgrade because
right.
It takes a long time or
right.
What have you, you know. They
don't have access to the technology for one reason or another.
Yeah.
And they're stuck on.
But the point of the whole thing is that, I mean, there's good issues and bad issues with that, but apparently one of the bad issues is this black hole in accessibility. So we'll post a link, obviously, to this podcast blog entry, so check it out. Leave a comment.
Yeah, let us know what you think about Google Chrome Frame for
IE. And if you have any experience with the accessibility of it, we'd love to hear it.
Absolutely. So there's a lot of events and conferences going on, which is great. Some of them are accessibility focused, and some have accessibility as a part of them, but not specifically focused. But the first one happened yesterday, right?
Yes. What's the date?
Today is the... We're recording this on the 27th.
So that was September 26th, yesterday, Saturday, at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California. And I've lived here 2 years now, but that was the first time I was actually on campus. It's a beautiful campus.
Imagine.
Yeah.
A lot of money going in there.
So yeah.
They can certainly afford it.
And, yeah, so John Foliot, who works at Stanford, helped put this together, and Opera was one of the main sponsors. And, yeah, it was a fun event. You know, it was a unconference. So Molly spoke at the beginning.
Yep, which is Molly Holschwag from, I think that's how you say it, right?
Yeah, I think so.
From Molly.com. So she is a standards advocate.
Mm-hmm. Now works for Opera.
Now works for Opera. Used to work for Microsoft.
And then Guy Kawasaki wrapped up the day.
Right, who is a well-known web entrepreneur.
And Twitter.
Yep. You said you Twitter 50 times a day.
20 to 50 times a day.
Yeah, that's a lot of tweets.
Oh, the part I didn't tell you, though, is that he has, he does all his tweets, except a lot of his tweets are, you know, he recommends our links, you know, he recommends articles or whatever to read. And he says those particular links, like a lot of them, he has a team of three people who search for like good articles and links, and they tweet for him, you know. Yeah, but all of his personal like tweets, like, you know, are directly from him.
So he's like a Twitter team.
Yeah,
all runs the Guy Kawasaki.
That'd be nice, huh?
Yeah.
I like one of those teams.
I always wondered how that would work. Is there going to be like somebody standing over your shoulder watching what you do and like? I'm now recording a podcast.
Yeah, but the event was pretty good. After Molly, I spoke on Twitter and web accessibility of Twitter and accessibletwitter.com, and that went over well. And you could view that presentation also on SlideShare.
Yeah, I've only been to one unconference before. I thought it was pretty cool. The idea is that there's no preset speakers or topics.
Right. There's no agenda. They had the two keynote speakers, but that was
it. Oh, right, right. I guess that makes sense.
And then in between, during the day, you just sign up and put, like, you put a post-it note on the time and room that you want to speak and the subject.
Right. So,
yeah
it's pretty
cool.
Anybody who wants to talk about anything can do so, and you only have to listen to what sounds good to you. And if not, you can start your own topic.
Yeah, then they had, like, in a couple openings, so they called them lightning sessions, when if you just wanted to get up for 5 minutes and rant about something. They call it lightning sessions.
That sounds
session.
Like fun.
Yeah.
Anybody do it?
A few people, not as many as I had hoped.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it was pretty cool. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of talk about web standards and HTML5 and a lot of talk about, you know, web accessibility and stuff. So, yeah, it was a good session. It was a good camp.
I can imagine those lightning sessions, especially with like a web standards group, you know, people get up there.
Yeah, there was, I mean, you know, there was a lot of, definitely a lot of open source kind of support.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, it was cool. Opera had like these sticker giveaways. There was Mozilla like pins, and I might have one for you. I don't
know. Oh, cool.
Yeah.
That would be awesome.
So yeah, and there was lunch provided and stuff. So it was a good time. But anyways, we have lots of other events going on that this fall. So a few already happened in September, but there's actually a couple free events in October in Washington, D.C. So thanks, Jennison, for FYI me on these events, for letting me know. The first one is October 5th and 6th. What is it? Interagency Disability Educational Awareness Showcase.
Ideas
for short. That's better.
Yeah.
Ideas 2009 at the Marvin Center, George Washington University. Says for anyone who wants to learn more about and network with folks who need to meet Section 508 requirements.
Right on. And then the next one is Accessibility Camp DC. See, that's a nice, short, easy to remember and say name.
Yeah.
If they could. They could teach the ideas people a thing or two about accessible names. No, I'm just kidding. And that's October 10th at the Martin Luther King Library. And this is a bar camp, which is another type of unconference. And it's for people who work or have an interest in IT accessibility. So that would be pretty cool to go to and see if you're near D.C. or feel like seeing D.C.
Yeah, totally.
And then we have a few other ones that are coming up in October.
Let's see. Yeah, October 12th to 13th, in Event Apart Chicago at the Sheraton Towers.
Yeah.
So an Event Apart is always a great one to attend.
Yep, it's put on by the Happy Cog people, and they also do the List Apart website. So, yeah, usually a lot of really good big speakers and good information there. I've never actually been to one, but I've heard good things.
Yeah, I've been to the last two in San Francisco.
They're pretty good?
Yeah, they're real good. You know, real good speakers and real good content, and they always had nice lunches.
That's good. That's important.
And good networking.
Right.
Yeah, those are good events. You know, a lot about just web standards and on the cutting edge of things, so.
Definitely.
I highly recommend that one. But I also highly recommend the next one.
Which is the 12th Annual Accessing Higher Ground. Accessible Media, Web, and Technology Conference, and that's November 10th through the 14th in Westminster, Colorado, USA. And
it's right outside of Denver.
Okay. And the keynote speaker is T.B. Rahman, is that it?
I guess that's how you pronounce his name. I don't know.
So he's a research scientist at Google.
Yeah, and this was an event that I'm speaking at this year and spoke at last year also. It's hosted by the University of Colorado. And last year it was pretty much, well, almost on campus in Boulder. But this year it's in Westminster, which is in between like Denver and Boulder, at a real nice, looks like a real nice hotel and resort place. So yeah, I'm excited. I'm going to be speaking, of course, about accessible Twitter.
Very good.
And I think I'm speaking on the 12th. The 10th and 11th, Tuesday and Wednesday, is like the pre-conference workshops. And then Thursday is the 12th, I believe, is when I'm speaking, Thursday morning at like 9:15 or something. And then it goes Friday and a half day Saturday. Mm. So, and it's not expensive at all. So if you could make it out to Denver, I recommend it. The actual conference fee is only like $350 or $400 or something.
Yeah, it's pretty low for conference these days.
Yes, and it's 2.5 days, so it's definitely worth the money. And yeah, and the focus of the conference is, well, obviously accessibility, but it's more, it's focused a little more on like assistive technologies and accessibility at like at learning institutions and e-learning and things like that.
Okay.
So that's a little bit more of the focus of that one.
Gotcha. That sounds like a good one. I'll see if I can make it out there and see your speech.
Are you used to saying that? Or?
It'll depend on the time, but you know, I've always wanted to see Colorado. And here particularly, Boulder is pretty nice.
Boulder's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very cool. I call it the Ann Arbor of the West.
And, you know, I've heard that before. So that there's very few places like Ann Arbor, but Boulder's one of them.
Yeah. Oh, we got the one more just to mention.
Okay.
An Event Apart, also in the one in San Francisco, is a little later this year. It's December 7th and 8th.
Okay.
Which I think it was at the Palace Hotel last year also. And this year, downtown San Francisco.
Yep. So that's another one put on by the Event Apart group, except this one's in San Francisco. So if you're in California or nearby, it's a good one to check out. And then on the other coast, Future of Web Design 2009 is going on in New York City, and that's being put on by the Car Sonified people.
Oh.
And I hear that those are pretty good, too. I might try and make that one also.
Cool, man.
Yeah. I think that one's pretty reasonable. It's a one-day event. I want to say it's like $300. So.
Oh, it's one day?
Yeah, I think it's a one day. And they've got like a workshop, and then they have like sessions too. But, you know, there's some...
Dan Cederholm.
Yeah, Dan Cederholm.
Jason Santa Maria.
Yep.
Molly. Holschlag.
Holschlag.
That's Elliot, there's your last name.
Yeah. Elliot J. Stocks recently wrote the book Sexy Web Design.
Oh.
So they talk a lot about, you know, kind of new things that are going on. And I see one of the presentations is accessibility for a Web 2.0 world. So that might be a good one to check out also.
Oh, it says November 16th and 17th.
Yep.
So it's 2 days.
Yeah, let's see. I think the first day might be the workshop. Yeah, I think the first day is the workshop all day, and the second day is the presentations.
Ooh, I like that. I go up a little? A little more. Progressive enrichment with CSS3.
Ooh.
Oh, I like that. Progressive enrichment with CSS3. Okay.
That's by Dan Cederholm.
Go down. There was another eye-catching one.
Accessibility in a Web 2.0 world, which is Derek Featherstone.
Oh, wow. That sounds good. And here's another relevant we talked about yesterday, another relevant one. HTML5 killed XHTML2. You know, the XHTML2...
working group, I guess it is.
Yeah, yeah. Like it expires at the end of this year, December 31st or what have you, and it's not being continued.
Right.
It will be over, so HTML5, is it? That's why that's everybody. It's HTML5 is getting heated with all the debates about what's going into it, because it's going to be the next huge thing, because it... As Molly was saying yesterday, like, it doesn't only update HTML4, but it's the new update for XHTML, and it's the new update for, like, for the DOM.
Right.
Also, you know, and then it's addressing, or it's going to try to address the video, you know, and
yeah.
It's going to try to address this Canvas thing that we were
right.
talking about, and it's just going to be huge.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a kind of a very complicated spec right now. Even so much as, you know, there's going to be form field validation within the HTML, which is interesting. And
oh, yeah. The idea is you just put a validate attribute.
Yeah.
And then the browser is supposed to validate.
Right. Right. Which is...
which makes it easier for us.
Yeah, absolutely. Less work for us developers. I like it.
But does that mean you should still do server side?
I don't know. I guess it would depend on...
because if it doesn't require JavaScript, if it's... Well, I suppose you still need server-side if your browser doesn't support HTML5, but then it wouldn't...
Right. I think we probably will have to up to a point.
Because HTML5, not like XHTML2, HTML5 is backward compatible.
Right.
So if your browser is an HTML5 browser, it should still support HTML4.
Right.
And which doesn't have validate attributes, so you still would need to do...
Right.
Server-side. JavaScript's not enabled for the HTML4.
Yeah.
Anyways, okay.
Cool idea.
Are we getting off topic?
maybe a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah, so that should be a good one.
Yeah, that looks awesome.
About a lot of stuff. And I'll see if I can find out the price real quick before we move on. And it's taken a while, so...
Because you're tethering, right? Is that what's going on?
Yeah. All right. Well, let's just move on. You can look it up. It's not too expensive. Future Web Design, 2009, New York.
WebEx.
All right, so our main segment today,
okay.
which is back to basics.
Yeah, so consider this a refresher if you're an experienced web accessibility developer and coder, or an introduction if you're in office.
Yep. And it's always good to kind of go back and reacquaint yourself with the kind of the basics, you know, making sure the building blocks to get to the more advanced stuff anyways.
And sometimes you can get too far ahead of yourself if you're, like, studying HTML5 and this stuff. Or sometimes, you know, maybe if this isn't the main part of your job, you know, maybe you're falling behind.
Yeah.
So you want to catch up.
Yep. Especially, it wasn't too long ago that WCAG 2 came out and things changed slightly as far as how we should go about ensuring that our sites are accessible.
Yeah, there's two main ideas I want to talk about, POSH and then the WCAG 2. So with the WCAG 2, I was thinking we could cover all the different areas, but it's more of a general guideline, really, than WCAG 1. So I figured we'd cover POUR, P-O-U-R, before we do the rest. And it's the basic concept behind WCAG 2, and that is you want to make your website perceivable, operable, understandable, and robust.
Yep. So, I mean, I find that, you know, kind of as I'm developing a site, if I kind of keep these things in mind, it keeps me a lot further ahead of the curve when I go back and take kind of a closer look.
Yeah, it's good to have these ideas and notions like in the back of your mind when you're
right
every day when you're coding.
Right. And so those words by themselves don't make a whole lot of sense. So we can kind of talk about each one a little bit. So the first one is perceivable. And the idea here is that, you know, none of the interface elements should be invisible to any of the users for any reason.
So don't use, in other words, one example would be, don't use the display none.
Right. That would be an extreme example. Yeah, don't turn the interface off. But it could be, you know, JavaScript menus. If a user doesn't have JavaScript enabled, that makes that whole menu pretty invisible pretty quick.
Yeah, that's another good example.
So that would be a problem. And then they can't use the website or, you know, potentially Flash could be completely
another
invisible.
Another great example, yeah.
So,
yeah, like with Flash, you know, put a graphic there and then use progressive enhancement and replace your graphic with Flash.
Right, right. Or you could potentially have a whole HTML, if it's a navigation item, for example, you could have a whole HTML nav there and replace that with JavaScript and Flash.
Right.
So, yeah, progressive
adapt. Add the behavior on top of it.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, so the next one, operable. Users must be able to interact with the interface.
Yep. So there's a few things there. I think the example that sticks to my mind is I heard a presentation once that was talking about this where the alt attribute of a button was different than the text. And a user who had motor disability was speaking into a microphone that was supposed to recognize the, you know, what he was saying and then click on that item. And because it was misspelled, he couldn't actually operate with that piece of the interface.
Oh.
So that's, you know, kind of one example where, you know, the user actually has to be able to interact and use the interface. And that could potentially be ensuring that it's tab friendly.
Yeah, that's what your example just reminded me of. The one big obvious one is the, you know, keyboard accessibility.
Yeah.
And that if you don't have a mouse, your website should still be operable.
Right.
I.e. the keyboard.
Right. Right. And I'm sure there's some kind of extreme cases where maybe things overlap or whatever and you can't actually click on things and certain low resolutions or that sort of thing. Or it shouldn't be technology dependent to be able to operate, which could kind of go back to the whole Flash or JavaScript as well.
Yeah. Especially if it's proprietary, right?
Right.
Right. All right. So the next idea is understandable. Users must be able to understand understand the information and the interface.
So this could be a cognitive sort of thing, just like we were talking about the article earlier with autism.
Or it could be just that, say, maybe the navigation, you know, is terribly inconsistent and it's just, you know, too difficult.
Right.
Or it just changes around so much that you confuse the user.
Right, right. And that's a good point. This is a kind of a good place where accessibility and usability overlap.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, you can make some weird mystery meat navigation where you don't know what button takes you where, sort of thing.
Or you don't, like, it doesn't say, you know, on the page anywhere, you know, your username that, you know, that you're logged in under.
Yeah, yeah.
Or just, you know, all those kinds of easy usability things that get overlooked too often.
Right.
Often. Or even just as simple as, like, the language that you're using, you know, make sure it's appropriate for your audience.
Right, right. Yeah, because there's a lot of situations that, yeah, just using kind of maybe over-advanced language could really hurt accessibility. Think about cognitive sort of situations or, I mean, even adult ADD could be a reason to try and simplify some of the words and the language that you're using.
Or people that, you know, English or whatever language you're using is the second language
right.
for your user, you know, or obviously, or many, too many technical terms or what have you.
Mm-hmm. I kind of feel like this is one that gets overlooked a little more than it should, you know.
Mm.
I think most people who care about accessibility make sure that, you know, they can perceive and operate a website, but they might not go through the steps to make sure that it's really understandable.
Yeah, and we kind of alluded to that earlier with that article about the cognitive disabilities. It's overlooked, and it's a little more difficult to address. But I mean, making the language more simple is one of the more easier things to address, I think.
Yep.
So the last one's robust. Your website should be usable by a wide range of user agents, like browsers and assistive technologies.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, this gets more and more something we should pay attention to every day, just because we're getting online with so many different things, from, you know, phones to, you know, Nintendo Wii's or
IE6.
IE6, right. IE6.
Or
yes.
Lynx browsers,
yep.
Or, on-screen keyboard users and all kinds of stuff. So.
Right.
So I think the more the web grows and the more devices that are being used to access the web, and, I mean, it's just even a bigger and bigger reason, you know, to make your website, you know, accessible and use web standards and make it robust.
Exactly.
Plus, it makes it easier for you if you want to, you know, put that data somewhere else.
Right, right. Yeah, if you kind of build with...
share the data and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, with that in mind, you can use data in a lot of different ways, or if you want to really start focusing on, you know, a different market and it's already built to be robust, it's much easier to make like a mobile-friendly version of the site if it's already pretty mobile-friendly.
Yeah, if you've got the content separated from your style and separated from your behavior, you're good to go.
Exactly. So that's kind of the main idea for the WCAG 2 Disremember Poor.
Yeah, that's our WCAG 2 refresher.
Yep.
Now, the second refresher, before we go and do a few more specific things, is the term I've always liked, posh.
Yes, just be posh.
Yeah, P-O-S-H.
It's fun to say, which
posh.
Is why I like it. My semantic HTML is very posh.
Plain old semantic HTML. P-O-S-H.
Yep. So the idea is, you know, it's kind of the frame or the structure of your documents that you're creating, and just, you know, put the time in needed to make sure that you build the document properly with semantics and correct use of HTML and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so this is the content portion of your website. So the HTML or HTML5 or XHTML or whatever, and that you want to use just plain old semantic HTML. You want to code it semantically. So use, and this is one of my pet peeves. So hopefully a lot of people's pet peeve. And, you know, and what we mean by that is code your content for what it is. So if you have a heading, you know, market it as a heading. Don't mark it, you know, just with a bold tag, you know,
right.
Paragraph and bold tag or something. If it's a heading, so please mark it as a heading. So, and all the stuff, if you're not in the know, you know, is not only good for web standards and web accessibility, but it's also good for like SEO and if you want to use this content for other sources or data and stuff, good reasons to do this. So, anyways, yeah. So besides. Do you want to say any more about headings? Or
yeah.
I could probably talk for a while.
Well, yeah, Dennis wrote down, use headings and use them properly. And I love the use it properly, because I think we've all seen like a website where every heading is a different H1 with like a different class, and that's what's making them bigger or smaller. That kind of defeats the purpose. I don't know if people do it for SEO, thinking that more H1s is better. Or what, but yeah, I mean, you should really have...
I'm hoping it's ignorance.
Yeah, me too. So you really should have, like, a hierarchy to your headings. There should be, you know, an H1, and then H2s. And if there's a subheading there, then you get to an H3. You know, they shouldn't all be random or chosen based on style. Like, you shouldn't choose an H5, just the small
one. You should mark it all up properly, mark up your content properly first.
Right.
And then after that, add in your CSS and JavaScript and stuff after. Yeah. So if you're marking up all the content first, then it's pretty easy. You just mark it as, you know, like, I don't want to say outline format, but, you know, your heading for your article or what have you is an H1, or maybe the name of your site. And then, you know, your subsections or subheadings of the article, H2, and so on and so forth. And your paragraphs, what do you mark your paragraph?
You mean the P tag?
Yeah, I was just messing with you.
Oh, okay.
Use P for paragraph.
Yes. It's an important one.
I knew you knew the answer.
Oh, okay. I thought it was a trick question or something.
No, it wasn't a trick question.
What are you setting me up for? This is one that I don't see quite as much anymore, but it used to be really big. Block quotes for quotes and not indentation. There used to be a lot of, you know, web authoring software that if you wanted to indent, it would put it in a block quote tag. Yeah. Because one of the things it does is indent.
You know what's really weird? It's really disappointing. I'm a Dreamweaver advocate, you know, and I like all the features of it and stuff. But I do have one gripe. I tweeted about it the other day. Is in the properties bar at the bottom, if you're marking up your content, if you want to do a block quote, you know what the tooltip is for that icon?
What?
It says indent.
Oh.
I'm like, what? This is CSS 4. Dreamweaver CS4.
Wow.
And I was like, no way.
Yeah, they should have figured that one out.
Yeah, yeah. So that was... apparently, somebody looked over that.
Yeah, you're hurting us, Adobe. What are you doing? Breaking my heart.
But anyways, so what else? Use lists for lists.
Yeah, that's a good one. And menus.
So if you have a list of items, use a UL or OL tag with LIs.
Yeah, versus doing like one period, two period, or I've even seen people do the and bold tag, you know, to do the character, the bullet, to do bulleted lists without actually doing another
list. They do
what? So you know in HTML you can have your character codes?
Like, yeah.
Yeah, so I've seen people do the character code for a bullet to do like a bulleted list rather than do an actual unordered list. So...
Or a lot of times I see, you know, they just put a hyphen or something.
Right.
Which I suppose is okay, but it's definitely not optimal.
Right. It doesn't mark it up as an actual list.
Right. And, you know, if you wanted a special bullet or graphic or whatever, then don't put in a graphic. Just mark it up as a list, like we just said, and use CSS because that is your style. So use CSS to change those bullets.
Exactly. It's much easier to do it that way than have a whole bunch of images.
Yeah.
And don't forget about definition lists. I think those aren't used as much as they probably could be.
Yeah, I love the definition list.
Yeah.
Your DT and your DDs and your DLs.
Yeah.
Especially because of the DLs. That's my initials.
Uh-huh. It does make it much better.
No, we've talked about this before. What are some examples of where you use a definition list? Well, the obvious one is like a dictionary kind of thing, a glossary.
Right.
Where you have the terms.
Right.
A DT is your definition term, and then a DD is the actual definition of that term. That's where it comes from.
Yep. And I've actually seen it used pretty well to define service offerings. So the DT would be like the name of the service, and then the DD would be like the elements of like what that service offering is.
Mm.
So if you said, you know, web design, you'd say, you know, accessibility audits, and then, you know, accessible coding, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Oh, that was kind of a clever use. There's a lot of ways you can use definition lists. Just keep your mind open to it.
That's for sure.
And then use strong and EM instead of the B and I tags for bold and italic.
Right. And the only exception that I could think of to that is if it's like a name of a magazine.
Yeah.
Or something like that, where you can, that should be italicized.
Right.
Right? Am I right?
Yeah, I guess.
Because that's not, you're not emphasizing the name of the magazine, but it should be italicized. I can't really think of any other cases.
Yeah, the only other case, and it's kind of a close call between if it would really make sense to be like a B tag or a span tag. I think the idea is that B and I are presentation only, where strong and M actually have some sort of semantic meaning. Mm-hmm. But maybe if you're doing like a drop cap, where you don't really want to put more emphasis on the first letter, but it is kind of a visual sort of thing where you have to have some HTML making that, you know, first letter really big for kind of that style,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of a visual presentation only thing.
So you're saying a span or a B tag maybe?
Yeah. I think, a span is probably a little less controversial, but a B tag maybe could work in that situation.
I suppose I might be able to play along with that. But I would probably argue in that case, I think we're maybe at the time where you can say, well, I'm just going to use a CSS pseudo element.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, for like progressive enhancement kind of deal. And if your browser doesn't support that, then forget it.
Right. Well, that's a good point. Either way. Probably a better way to go about it. And tables for tabular data.
Right. Don't forget that tables are good for tabular data.
Right. Right.
So if you actually have a data table, use a table.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, mark it up correctly with your headings and scopes, or right. your headers and scopes.
Yeah. Yeah, and I actually, maybe you have too, but come across a few websites where it's like people have gone out of their way not to use tables when they probably should have for data.
I have
using,
seen that.
Using like unordered lists and spans and stuff like that.
Yeah, crazy columns. Divs and spans to make columns. Yeah. They're like, what the?
Right.
Oh my God.
It would be more accessible if they did use tables. But
yeah.
So, yes, in the right situation, tables are not bad. They are your friend. Just don't use them for layout.
Exactly. Okay, so that covers the main points for using being posh for writing your plain old semantic HTML. And we just have a few other things to talk about because we don't want to take too much time. We still have to go to Santa Cruz and drink a couple beers.
Absolutely, that's a requirement. So sorry if everybody wants to hear us talk more of the beer calls.
I think we've covered a lot of it already, right. But let's just cover a few more things that are definitely worth mentioning for our recap here of your basic accessibility development.
Yep. So one of them is use alternate text for non-textual elements. And this is actually a pretty huge debate about HTML5, right? The alt attribute might not be required.
Yeah, I think it's still going back and forth.
Yeah.
So, but, I mean, I'm not worried about it. I'm just sticking to my guns and saying, well, you know, HTML5 isn't going to be, well, I mean, it's starting to come out on the web, but it's not going to be dominating the web for years and years to come, I think. So,
right.
So for a while, I'm still going to be saying, don't forget your alt attribute!
Please, it's so easy to do.
Yeah, and a lot of people remember but don't do it correctly.
Right. I think that's the trickier part, is to really make sure that it's done right.
And I know we've done a podcast, one or two,
I think so.
Talking a lot about this, so maybe we can link to it or go find it if I forget to.
Right. Do a search if it's not there.
So,
we might have had too many beers by then.
So basically, mostly what we're talking about is images. So if you have an image, you know, that's not there just for purely decoration, then you want to put an alt attribute on that image tag and describe, you know, briefly, hopefully, you know, between about 5 and 15 words and what that image is.
Yeah.
Right? 5 and 20 words or so.
Yeah.
And then if you can't do that, then you should still describe it, but also provide the alternative text in a different format. So either just with a hyperlink or just on the page itself or through a long description attribute.
Yeah. And then kind of a big one lately is kind of the whole CAPTCHA, which we talked about before. But obviously this could potentially be a huge accessibility barrier if somebody's trying to register or do something on your site, fill out a form. and have images turned off, or for whatever reason can't see that CAPTCHA.
Like if the user's blind?
Right, right. It'd be a very common one. So you have to have some sort of alternative there, and that's typically audio, right?
Yeah, a lot of people are using audio now. And the reCAPTCHA service is getting really popular. It's a pretty solid service. I think the one thing I think I had against it was that it requires JavaScript.
Yeah, does it?
I believe so.
Huh.
I believe so. So if you don't have JavaScript, then it's not going to work.
Right.
That's a whole other debate right there.
Right.
But, there's alternatives around it, though. You know, but then there's arguments against those, too.
Yeah.
I guess you could ask the users this: what color is the water? What's 3 times 7 or something?
Right.
But then some people will say, well, then you have people with cognitive impairments. So, yeah, this is a debate that's long going.
Yeah. The one that I've been using lately that I think works pretty well is you actually have a form element that is hidden most of the time, but the label says something like, don't fill this in. And so it's kind of like a trick. You know, the bots are going to try and fill in everything they can.
Yeah.
And if it does get filled in, then that's when you flag it. But at least, you know, if somebody has a screen reader, it's going to tell them, don't fill in this
right.
field or something like that. A little confusing still, I'm sure, but it's clever.
Yeah, that's a good one. So, okay, what else? We've talked about tables.
Yep. So make sure you build your tables correctly, which means using, you know, summary, a caption, using table headings, defining the scope.
Scope equals row or scope equals column on your headings?
Yep.
Headers?
Yep. And actually, the newer versions of Dreamweaver do have this built in, and I thought that was pretty nice.
Yeah, that's pretty good. And then forms.
Oh, forms.
Yes, forms.
I hate working with forms, but, you know, they're so important to...
I like working with forms.
Really? Yeah. Oh, I can't stand it.
I think it's fun.
I try and have other people do my forms for me. That's work I offload.
So, your forms. Let's start with the first thing. Well, you've got your form tag. That's pretty straightforward.
Right.
Then you got your field set tag. Some people say you should always have a field set in a legend. Some people say if it's a short form, it's not required. What do you say?
If it's pretty short, I will leave it out. But I kind of think it's a good practice regardless just to do it, unless mm-hmm. there's some kind of compelling reason. And this is one of the things where I could probably be better myself about, you know, always using them. But when I think about it, I think it's kind of a good idea. It's not hurting anything to put it there.
Yeah, I think I would say the same thing. I used to say that if your form was short, then just, you know, you don't need a field set or legend. But it is nice just, like you said, it's not hurting anything and to be consistent, you know.
Right.
And so if you're unfamiliar with what that is, the field set is usually, on most browsers, will render it as like the box around your form.
Yeah.
And the legend is the label for that box or the label of that section of the form. So if you have a longer form, you could segment the form into, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 sections. So it's easier to navigate through for anybody.
Yeah. Yeah, and even if it's a short form, you know, just to have the box and contact us kind of, you know, groups that all together.
Yeah.
I think it, from a cognitive standpoint, makes it, you know, a little more comprehensive. So
totally.
It's a good idea.
And then the label tag,
yeah.
You want to wrap around the label for your form elements.
Right.
So properly, so if it says name, you want to put the label tag using IDs and 4 attributes to tie that together with your name input field.
Right, right. So I think that's a good point. Just because you have something wrapped in a label tag doesn't mean it's accessible. You do have to use kind of like the form or the 4 attribute so that you can associate it, that label, with a proper text or proper input.
Now, I've heard that if you have name and then you have the field, you have last name and then the field, you know, people will say that, well, that's accessible. And I say, well, I'd say, yeah, that's my battery running out. I'd say, on my computer. We record it on Rob's computer.
Yeah. The podcast won't end suddenly.
Some people say that, well, that's accessible. It's fine. And I agree. Yeah, that's accessible, but it's not optimal. You know,
right.
Make it more accessible to use those label tags, but it's also more usable because then the user can click on those labels to highlight,
right.
You know, to activate or deactivate the element.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you should definitely, it doesn't take, you know, much to add in, you know, label tags. So
yeah.
You might as well. It's one of those things where even, okay, maybe you don't necessarily have to and have it be accessible, but you probably should.
Yeah. And like we were saying, you know, with the field sets and legends, be consistent.
Right.
And, you know, be proud of your work.
Right.
Be thorough and consistent and nice.
Right. And kind of a side bonus is it gives you a little bit more markup to work with on your styling, too. So you can kind of work with the style a little better if you're trying to have, you know, the label and the field parallel. Or
definitely. Gives you more hooks for styling.
Right. Exactly. So.
And it gives, because it's, you can wrap that label text with something, with a tag, and you don't leave it so open-end.
Yep.
Yeah, there's looks not how much we could talk about with just the label tag.
Right. The wonderful label tag.
So, quickly, more about forms is always a good idea to use a submit button.
Yep.
Don't leave that out and leave it up to JavaScript or a return or something goofy because you never know.
Right, yeah. Submitting on change with JavaScript or submit with action, that sort of thing. I've seen it happen on a lot of websites, so it's a pretty big problem if your form doesn't work without JavaScript, so you definitely don't want to do that.
Yeah, and if you're validating on the front end, you know, use unobtrusive JavaScript.
Yep.
And also, you know, remember to validate on the server side, too.
Yep, yep.
In case the user has it off, or the device or whatever, you know. Always want to be careful about that still.
Yeah, that's something I've been doing more and more, just because, you know, there's jQuery plugins that make front-side validation so easy. You can kind of help users as they're going through your form. But I never forget about the server side, either. It's kind of, you got to do both.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I was thinking about having a whole podcast about this kind of JavaScript debate.
Right.
And it just got me thinking that, you know, I don't agree, but I could see the argument where browsers today, you know, like, all have JavaScript and everybody uses JavaScript, blah, 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 blah. I mean, that's not totally true, but even if that was true, I mean, you still have to think about mobile devices and you still have to think about firewalls and all this kind of stuff. So I'm still strongly behind the non-JavaScript support.
Right.
And accessible Twitter works completely without JavaScript, too. So.
Yeah.
Just so you know.
Leading by example.
That's right.
And speaking of JavaScript, what about JavaScript?
Yeah, what else can we say about JavaScript?
Yeah, so you should,
besides forums, we have other things to do or not do with JavaScript.
Yeah. So opt for server-side over JavaScript where you can. That's a good practice.
Yeah, like not only for validation, but for just, you know, any other kind of, you know, core functionality of your website, you know, you want to always use server-side over JavaScript because you never know what's going to happen if the JavaScript's going to work or not.
Right.
And implement the progressive enhancement. We've kind of mentioned that before, which I like that term more than graceful degradation.
Yeah.
You know why?
I know why. I like it better.
Why do you like it better?
I like the idea of starting with something that that works perfectly without all the bells and whistles, and then adding the bells and whistles versus starting with the coolest thing and trying to make it work by taking stuff away.
By going backwards. Yeah. Right. That's exactly what I was thinking. You should start with the lowest baseline.
Right.
Then work up. Don't start from the top and then work backwards.
Right.
Because that ain't going to work.
Right. Yeah, you can run into problems pretty quickly there.
Yeah.
Versus thinking about it in the first place.
And if you can make that work, I'd like to know how you did it.
Right. Yeah, so the idea is simply start with something that's completely accessible and then, you know, add layers as technology becomes available.
Yeah, add CSS2, then add CSS3.
Right.
Enhance behavior, make it work with server-side calls, then make it work with Ajax or whatever.
Yep.
Which brings us to the next point that I had on the list is Hijax.
Yep.
Which is basically what I just said. It's unobtrusive Ajax. It's an idea and term coined from Jeremy Keith.
Yep.
Who we will have on the show very soon.
Yes. Yeah, so stay tuned for that.
He's one of my heroes with his Hijax book.
Yeah.
It's been around a few years now.
It's amazing that Ajax has been around for that long.
I know.
And I guess even longer than that, but I guess popular for that long.
Although I can't believe it has been misused for that long.
Yeah.
Okay.
We've got a fire drill going on, apparently. As the battery dies in Dennis's computer. So, yes, while we're shutting down that computer, definitely use Hijax. Which is unobtrusive Ajax, meaning that the web application or the website will work without JavaScript, even if you plan on using Ajax. And then when JavaScript is present, that's when you start working in the Ajax. And I think the last element is use unobtrusive JavaScript. This is definitely not as bad as it used to be before, but I do see it from time to time.
Yeah, and we've mentioned that a few times already. So basically that means just remove your JavaScript from your code, from your inline HTML. Put it either in the header of your document and more preferably in an external JavaScript file.
Yep. And then device independence. So this is kind of the robust...
Yeah, exactly, the robustness. So, we've mentioned these points already that, don't require the use of a mouse or mouseovers, in other words. If you're using, for example, in CSS, if you're using the hover pseudo element,
yep.
And always remember to use the focus pseudo element. And I've recently learned that you should also use the active pseudo element along with that, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't use active as much as I should, even though recently I did write a blog post.
If you think about it, it makes sense.
Yeah, about how people should use active more often.
Right on.
that means, make sure that any device can use the site.
And you're able to keyboard through tab through your site.
Right. Various different input devices.
Let's talk about visual impairments briefly. Just a few items about that. You want to be able to nicely resize your website and that it handles that well.
Yep. And with modern browsers, that actually is getting easier and easier because it does more of a zoom than text resizing. Not that you want to ignore it, but used to be a lot harder when just the text resized. You have to worry about things overlapping and that sort of thing.
That is true. And heading size. Can't remember what that is. But the color contrast is a good one.
Yep.
Yeah. Always remember, of course, not only blindness, but people that are colorblind, which is almost 10% of the population, they say, have some kind of color blindness.
Yep, so that's very significant. So make sure you have enough color contrast. And there's a lot of good tools out there to test how your site looks with different types of color blindness. So,
and I haven't done that as much as I should. Although I did recently install Firefox, there's a really good color contrast analyzer installed.
Oh, cool.
So I ran that on Twitter and Accessible Twitter the other day. And I was pleased with the results.
Oh, good.
But anyways, so that's definitely a good one.
Another easy one to overlook. And then flashing can be a problem, so be careful about having anything that's flashing for neurological reasons.
Right. And I don't remember what the rate is or anything, but...
Yeah.
I think it's like more than 3 times a second, and I think it roughly what it comes down to.
Right.
You don't want to flash yourself.
Right.
Make things flash
more
often than that, so be careful. All right, we'll just recap. One other issue is the audio. just a reminder on that, if you have audio going on your website, make sure you have some kind of text-only version of that, if it's pertinent to the content of your site. And we've talked about PDFs and we've talked about CAPTCHA. I think we've covered all the bases.
Yep. So if you kind of pay attention to these things and you know, keep it in mind while you're building your site, you'll end up with you know some pretty accessible sites out there.
Yeah. And if you think we've forgotten anything, please you know send us a note or a comment on the blog and we'll definitely respond.
Yep. Maybe include it in the next episode or two.
For sure.
So that everybody can hear and see the answer as well. So,
okay. Well, that's it for podcast 74. What was it? Awards, events, and back to basics.
Yep.
Okay.
Thanks. Live from Santa Cruz, or I guess not live, but from Santa Cruz.
Okay, we'll signing out from Santa Cruz.
We're off to go get beer.
Catch you next time.
Find the WebEx podcast and blog at webex.blogspot.com. That's WEBAXE.blogspot.com.